You know the day destroys the night, night divides the day. Try to run, try to hide, break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side, yeah.
This is WBCR LP 97.7 on your FM dial, broadcasting from downtown Great Barrington in the Berkshire Hills of Western Massachusetts. That was The Doors. And this is Mickey Friedman. And this is The Other Side. There are, of course, many sides and many truths. This show is about some of the other sides of the story. My pick of the many stories out there. Dar Jamal, born and raised in Houston, Texas, now finds himself one of a few independent journalists reporting on the war in Iraq from the front lines. We hear excerpts from several interviews he conducted while on a recent trip back to the States. If you have children about or young people who might be too upset by hearing about this war of ours, now might be a good time to switch the dial.
This is Dar Jamal. I'm an independent journalist. I've been working in Iraq for several months of the last year and a half. And what I've seen consistently with the situation with the troops there is that morale is low and getting lower by the day. When people first show up, for example, if it's their first tour, they are believing in their mission. They are believing they are coming to try to help Iraqis and that it is somehow involved in defending America and making America more secure. But then consistently what I've seen is the longer people are there, the lower their morale is and the less they believe in these ideas that they had when they first arrived. And I've seen it degrade down to the point where troops are randomly shooting people, being extremely trigger happy. It's just really turned into a horrific situation. And of course, they're no longer believing in what they're doing there. They feel used. They feel betrayed. They're angry because they look around and they see these mercenaries and other corporations with workers there who are making 10 times the money that they are, sometimes even more than that, and that they see the disparity and they feel it, and they're well aware after they've been there even a short time of what's going on and what situation they've been in. And there already now are logged instances of mutinies and people turning into conscientious objectors, even when they're in Iraq and joining groups like Iraq Veterans Against the War. So already there are definitely cracks in the pillar, which is the troops. And word travels very quick through the military ranks. And already we see now in the U.S. the military is failing to meet its recruiting goals across the board. And this is an increasing trend for them. And, for example, I know a man named Fernando Suarez who lost his son in Iraq, and he's involved heavily with Military Families Speak Out. And this is one example that I like to cite because he goes into to high schools and speaks with students in a non-threatening way. He says, I'm just here not to dissuade you from joining the military, but to give you the information that the recruiters are not telling you. So if you're going to make this choice, you have all the information. And he said that by doing this, that he's already received personally 2,000 letters from students who said, thank you for the information. I was thinking seriously of joining, but after hearing your information, I decided not to. And I think if this kind of work continues, then it's definitely going to make it far more difficult for the government to be waging this continuous war.
Come on.
I've been working in Iraq for 8 of the last 15 months, and here today to talk a bit about the situation of independent media in Iraq, joined by independent filmmaker and independent journalist Mark Manning from California, who has recently returned from Fallujah, where he spent many, many days documenting the atrocities which have occurred there. This interview is against the backdrop, really, of an obviously a continuation of the media crackdown and blackout regarding independent media and people essentially telling the truth about the situation in Iraq. We have a situation now where Al Jazeera's offices, for example, have been banned for several months now. They're banned indefinitely from reporting about the situation because they've been consistently critical about the occupation. And now their entire operation in Iraq is essentially 1 to 2 people operating with satellite phones, basically calling in reports. The stifling of the independent media is intense. Even the Iraqi government has announced that if any Al Jazeera journalist was found, they would immediately be detained. Even today, we see that the Italian independent journalist who writes for a leftist newspaper, Il Manifesto, she was recently released from having been kidnapped for several weeks. And while her car was on the way to Baghdad airport, it was shot up with 300 to 400 rounds by U.S. soldiers in an area that is already beyond and inside the safety zone, inside the military base that is the Baghdad airport. And one of her, one of the Italian Secret Service agents with her, who was guarding her, was killed by gunfire of the U.S. soldiers. And the others have claimed that it is a deliberate act by the U.S. military, yet again, against independent media. So, with that as the backdrop, I'm going to ask Mark basically what he saw inside Fallujah. He was in there for about a week and did a lot of really incredible reporting there. So essentially, first, Mark, what did Fallujah look like? What were your first impressions when you went into the city?
Fallujah has been devastated. I think about 65% of the buildings and homes in Fallujah have been destroyed. And the rest have all been damaged. A lot of houses have been burned down, fired, as they call it. Whole neighborhoods have been leveled by airstrikes. Almost every shop has been torn apart and fired. There's evidence of DU shells everywhere. The city's been pretty much destroyed.
And what is the current situation? Because you basically just returned from there a couple of weeks ago. And what is the situation regarding rebuilding or electricity or water? Because I know that the corporate media here in the U.S. has left people in America with the impression that, well, the insurgent problem in Fallujah is solved. And so the city, things should be getting back to normal there and people should be getting back to their lives. Is this what you saw?
Pretty much the opposite. There is absolutely no rebuilding going on in Fallujah. To begin with, the people of Fallujah, it's about a city of about 400 and something thousand people. They were given a week to leave that city, 3 days notice, and after 3 days they had to walk out. They couldn't drive anymore. They were given absolutely nowhere to go, so they had to just leave the city or be killed. After that, anybody left in the city was considered a legitimate target. And those people are living out in the country. They're living in shacks. They're living in chicken coops. They're living in tents. There's been no aid provided for those people, no outside aid at all. And as far as any rebuilding going on, all I saw was children with shovels, you know, trying to dig out the rubble of their homes. It's a mess, and there's absolutely no foreign aid, no American aid, no rebuilding going on whatsoever.
And what is, if someone does want to, for whatever reason, return into the city amidst this horrible destruction inside, which you describe, what do they have to go through to get into the city?
Yeah, the city's been completely sealed. Every road in is now a checkpoint. There's only 4 ways to get into the city, and each way in is a checkpoint. So to get back into the city for a resident, they need to go into a military compound where they're being fingerprinted, all 10 fingers, and retina scanned. And they're being classified as a resident of Fallujah, which basically means that they're being classified as terrorists. Once you get that resident card, you can be detained. You can be detained for any reason whatsoever. My driver, when I was in there, had that card. And as you go through a checkpoint, they ask for your cards, and immediately they pull out the driver and they're going to detain him because he just has a resident card. So everybody that checks back in has to be retina scanned, fingerprinted, and officially be now a resident of Fallujah, which for an Iraqi is pretty much a death sentence or a sentence of no rights, and it's a mess. So as you go into the checkpoints, there's a long line of people. Sometimes they're in there for 2 days, and they're having to go in, get retina scanned, and it's really a terrible thing to see.
And all of this took place because under the justification of the attack, as stated by the U.S. military, that this was to bring security and stability for the January 30th elections. And after all was said and done, we have a situation where the Iraqi Red Crescent has estimated that over 3,000 people have been killed in Fallujah, but they're not sure of the numbers because they're still pulling bodies out of these collapsed houses. We do have mass graves in Fallujah, and even the military then admitted that maybe between 400 and 600 fighters were actually killed as a result of this, as a result of this utter devastation.
Bubble!
foreign aid, no American aid, no rebuilding going on whatsoever.
And what is, if someone does want to, for whatever reason, return into the city amidst this horrible destruction inside, which you describe, what do they have to go through to get into the city?
Now, the city's been completely sealed. Every road in is now a checkpoint. There's only four ways to get into the city, and each way in is a checkpoint. So to get back into the city for a resident, they need to go into a military compound where they're being fingerprinted, all 10 fingers, and retina scanned. And they're being classified as a resident of Fallujah, which basically means that they're being classified as terrorists. Once you get that resident card, you can be detained. You can be detained for any reason whatsoever. My driver, when I was in there, had that card. And as you go through a checkpoint, they ask for your cards, and immediately they pull out the driver and they're going to detain him because he just has a resident card. So everybody that checks back in has to be retina scanned, fingerprinted, and officially be now a resident of Fallujah, which for an Iraqi is pretty much a death sentence or a sentence of no rights, and it's a mess. So as you go into the checkpoints, there's a long line of people. Sometimes they're in there for 2 days, and they're having to go in, get retina scanned, and it's really a terrible thing to see.
And all of this took place because under the justification of the attack, as stated by the U.S. military.
As it turns out, I was one of the only Westerners that have been inside Fallujah since the siege. It might be even the only one. And I've done a lot of interviews there on camera with people who had been there, who witnessed chemical attacks, doctors who'd witnessed taking over of hospitals and destructions of hospitals, and people being pulled out of the operating room while they're being operated on. And I had a great body of information on videotape with that. I got back to the United States after being here for less than 10 hours. Somebody came into my hotel room when I wasn't there and busted in my automobile in a separate location, and they took the tapes. Since then, I've been under a pretty steady stream of harassment with cryptic phone calls, mail being stolen, just basic rudimentary in-your-face, we're watching you type of thing. I met a 17-year-old girl who told me her story, which was the most difficult story I've ever done in my life. I'll never forget her or the story she told me. She was living inside Fallujah in her house with her sisters, her brother, her father, her cousin, and a home raid happened during the siege. When they came in, they throw sound bombs in, they kick open the door. She grabbed her 13-year-old brother and ran upstairs and hid under the bed. While she was under the bed, they shot her family. Her two sisters, 18 and 16, stuff is still fresh, fell on the floor in front of her while she was hiding, and they shot them again. She had to see that, and then they left. She hid under that bed for 3 days with her brother, with her sisters dead in front of her, brains on the floor. And then they came back after 3 days and raided the house again, lifted up the bed and found her, and shot her and shot her brother, killed her brother. That interview, I think if the American people saw it, they would get an idea of what it's like to be at the foreign end of American foreign policy.
And I know that is just one example of countless others that occurred in Fallujah. I personally, when I was there, I interviewed many, many refugees telling other horrific stories along those lines, talking about these home raids. And I have photographs of people, of some of the results of these home raids where people were literally shot in their beds. And again, just situation after situation, on the same level as the one that you describe, which is, it's beyond imagination how horrific this is. This is a story similar to some of the things that some of the stories that came out of Vietnam. And I think it's difficult for people in America to grasp the idea that we're right there again. This kind of thing is happening on a daily basis in Iraq with these home raids and these detentions and just the ongoing injustices. And another aspect that I wanted to ask you about that perhaps you had some more evidence of on your tapes that I have personally, I have photographic evidence of on my website. And then I also have countless statements from refugees who'd come out of Fallujah at many different times. And this would be about the use of illegal weapons, of cluster bombs, phosphorus or napalm, and chemical weapons. What type of information did you have about those?
A lot of people that I interviewed that were there during the siege, if anybody was there, they talked about chemical weapons being used. They talked about mushroom clouds of strange colored gas rising in the air and then not being able to breathe, about being fortunate that it rained and that the wind was blowing. But to almost a man and woman, if you're in Fallujah and you talk to the people that are there, they say that chemical weapons were used. They also say that immediately following the siege, trucks came in and took a lot of the loose dirt away. Water trucks came in and sprayed down the roads and the houses. And soldiers went from house to house and went up on the roofs and busted open all the pigeon cages and collected all the dead birds and animals that were around so there'd be no evidence. Depleted uranium shells are almost impossible to hide because if you go from house to house, you'll see that the shells have gone through the walls, multiple walls, and the houses inside have been fried. So, I mean, that evidence is hard to find, and everybody's talking about chemical weapons and the cleanup work that was done with the animals and the water and the dirt. There's really no reason for that. was the very first thing that the forces, American forces, did was they came to the hospital and sealed it off. The first siege, they hadn't done that, and a lot of wounded civilians had come to the hospital, and word got out that of the civilian casualties, and it was played in the media, and it really hurt that operation, and I think it was one of the main reasons they had to stop. The second siege, the first thing they did is they went to the hospital and sealed it off. They went into the operating rooms. They pulled the doctors out while they were operating on patients. They pulled the patients out while they were being operated on and threw them in the dirt. They handcuffed the doctors and beat them. And they basically sealed the hospital off so that no patients could get there during the whole siege. They didn't see a patient during the whole siege. They also were shooting ambulances that were trying to get out. I interviewed ambulance drivers that had been shot. I have a lot of had a lot of photographic evidence of ambulances that were shot through the window, aimed at the driver. So basically, the doctors were isolated. The hospital was isolated. The hospitals inside the city where they have medical centers, they were raided and destroyed. And so basically no medical care was allowed to the people that were left inside Fallujah.
And now today that situation is essentially ongoing. What is the medical situation in Fallujah that you saw just prior to your leaving?
As of less than 3 weeks ago, the hospitals and medical centers inside the city have not been repaired. I think the main story about the hospital outside is that people are still not allowed really to go there. There's checkpoints blocking you to get to the hospital. So if you're sick, you have to walk. You have to walk through a very hostile checkpoint manned by the Iraqi National Guard, which are very hostile to the citizens of Fallujah. The doctors there still have received no outside medical aid at all, and they're receiving no patients. If they send an ambulance out, it's still highly likely to get shot. I interviewed an ambulance driver that had been shot 2 days before. This is after the fighting really has stopped. A man died the morning I was there of a heart attack because they wouldn't let him through the checkpoint. A woman delivered a baby in an ambulance that did get out because they wouldn't let it back into the hospital. So we walked all the way through the hospital, and even in a city filled with sick refugees where there's still fighting going on, there was absolutely no patients.
And of course, all of this, it is basically a situation, it's an atrocity generating situation where we have war crimes have essentially become a fact of daily life for Iraqis who live inside Fallujah. All of this is violations of the Geneva Conventions and impeding medical care and not assisting in rebuilding it. This is just absolutely horrendous, lopped on top of the back of the utter devastation of Fallujah, which, of course, followed the April siege, which I had not quite as an intense of an experience as you, but I did go into the city in April and saw many of the same things as far as ambulances being shot, doctors being shot, everyone in their homes talking about being shot by snipers. And I think that there have been many similarities in both sieges and the tactics used, except it sounds as though for this latter siege, that it's just been exponentially worse than the April siege, even. And just by comparison, what did you see or hear people talk about regarding snipers?
Snipers are still a big threat. And if you you walk down the street, you can't miss them. And people are really afraid to be out on the street. There's a sniper on pretty much every high ground you can see. There's a lot of stories of snipers shooting people for just walking down the street. There was a lot of stories I heard about citizens who couldn't get their act together to get out in the week that was given, who tried to get out of the city after that, and they were just shot for trying to get across the river, trying to get across a bridge. It's a dangerous place to be walking around. Yeah, the snipers are mainly U.S. soldiers. They're Iraqi snipers also, Iraqi National Guard. They are the coalition snipers, I'll put it that way. And it's like I said, it's hard to walk anywhere without having a gun sight on you from the coalition, the occupation. So they're either armed by the Marines or the Iraqi National Guard. You know, the really amazing thing about Fallujah is this war was supposedly not against the people of Iraq. And you cannot miss the fact that this is a war against the people of Iraq if you go to Fallujah. because there was absolutely no care given for citizens, and there's still no care given for citizens. You don't ask a city of 400,000 to 500,000 people to leave, give them no time to leave, and give them nowhere to go, and say that this is not a war against the people of Iraq. And they don't miss that. Not for a second.
Every morning I get up and I watch the war. Watch the war. And every morning it upstages all my favorite shows. Donna you and Hogan's heroes. Every morning I get up and I raise the flag. Salute the monument of those who gave their lives. And I guess war's okay. It's just a little inconvenient. But it's better than a video game. And it's better than the movies. It's the American way. The new world order. We hold these truths to be self-evident. Well, this is evident. In the American way. You must give and I shall take. I will tell you what is moral and what's just. Because I want, because I will, because I can. So will I. Because I want, because I will, because I can. Oh, so will I. Well, this is evident, yeah. In the American way, you must give and I shall take. I will tell you what is moral and what's just. Because I want, because I will, because I can. I am so well. I, because I want, because I will, because I can.
Overall, the corporation's role so far, their primary role appears to have been winning these massive contracts and being paid millions and millions of dollars, I'm sorry, billions of dollars of U.S. taxpayer money for doing next to nothing outside of Halliburton, even though they've already been caught in fraudulent operations, for example, overcharging the Pentagon for importing gasoline into Iraq. Back in even December of 2003, they were overcharging. They were charging $2.73 a gallon, and Iraqi concerns could have done the same thing for under a dollar a gallon. Yet they continue to be awarded contracts to basically build and support these military bases. And then we have Bechtel, the next biggest company in there, who essentially have already been paid out their initial contract of $680 million. And I've looked in extensively into, for example, the water treatment portion of their contract, which I focused on three of the cities they said they had rehabilitated the water treatment plants, Hilla, Najaf, and Diwania. And they've done next to nothing. And people are suffering because of this. And Iraqis are extremely angry because they did believe that these corporations would come in, A, give them jobs, B, begin this reconstruction to really improve the quality of their lives. And none of this is happening. One of the first things that these Bremer orders did was essentially open up the Iraqi economy. For example, half of the banks now are open to foreign ownership. There are no import tariffs any longer. So immediately, one of the first things we saw happen on the ground after the invasion was Iraqi markets were flooded with foreign goods, far less expensive than Iraqi goods. So essentially it made it almost impossible for independent Iraqi businesses to even function and compete. So, and this is why there's such huge unemployment now. So it's already not even 2 years into the occupation, the Iraqi economy is devastated by these acts and these moves towards privatization. If we don't have mercenaries, for example, if not only the military is starting to not meet their recruitment goals, but if there's not enough mercenaries, and we're already starting to see this happen with these companies now having to go outside even of America, they're offering to pay people $1,000 and $1,500 a day, and that's not even enough to lure people. Already we're starting to see some of the effects if they're having to go outside of the country to get these people. And if enough pressure is applied consistently to these companies and to disrupt their goals of recruiting workers to send over and to fulfill this role, freeing up the government to continuing on its launching wars into other countries, then yes, this would be a very critical factor and have a very heavy impact on the situation.
Opposition to the war in this country is the greatest single weapon working against the U.S. That's the 7 o'clock edition of the news. Good night.
And then we have the election, another example of this misrepresentation where the mainstream media reported 70% turnout. This was the figure that Mr. Bush and Condoleezza Rice spoke about, but of course they didn't report that this figure was provided by the spokesman for the High Commission of Elections in Iraq, who gave that statement and then two sentences later in the same press conference corrected himself and said, no, actually it was probably in the 60%, upper 60s maybe, voter turnout. And then a journalist asked how he got that figure, and he said, well, actually, people in the voting stations just leaned out the doors and looked and kind of estimated how many people from their neighborhood they thought came to vote. So we really can't trust that figure either. We'll just have to wait until the votes are counted, because it could even be less than that. So that, of course, wasn't even reported. Instead, people in America are left with this impression that there's high 60% or low 70% turnout, which is simply not the case, or the fact that the media in Baghdad, for example, were only allowed to go to 4 polling stations. These were polling stations located in predominantly Shia neighborhoods with extra security, where there was expected to be high voter turnout, and there was. And these are the video images that people were – this is where the video images were taken of people, the happy Iraqis holding their inked fingers in the streets, celebrating the vote. And this is what was shown to the people in America, as if this having this thing that somewhat resembled an election on the ground somehow justifies this failed occupation. And the reality was, Iraqis were voting to end the occupation. This is an information war, and we've been consistently reacting to this disinformation put out by the corporate media, by the Bush administration, when it's not even based in reality, and yet here we are caught up in this inane argument. And the reality is, if independent media and just go out and do their job and tell the story and tell the truth and have the photos and have the eyewitness interviews and consistently put this out, and activists are more successful in bringing in more listenership or readership and also getting the information out wider to a wider audience, then this is the path, I think, because people know the truth when they see it, and that has been the reaction that I've had coming back from Iraq, giving presentations, and people just simply being blown away by, here are the stories, here are the photos to back them up, here's some footage, you can see for yourself. And they can see that this is the truth, there's no bias, this is simply the situation on the ground in Iraq. And when people are given that, then they know that. And that itself, just going out and working to get that information and getting it out there, is the act. That's the path, rather than continuing to react to the disinformation and the lies put out by the corporate media. When I first showed up in Iraq, I had done an immense amount of reading before I went, various news outlets from all around the world, independent media, alternative media as well. And I thought that I had a pretty good idea of what to expect. But when I showed up, still, what struck me is, despite all the reading I had done, I still had some of this programming and simply being in the culture of the United States that when I showed up, still, I had these expectations that it wasn't going to be quite that bad. And my head was spinning at how bad it was. It was insanely horrible, and it's gotten exponentially worse since then. And this is it's just really a mind-blowing thing to see how powerful that spin machine and the corporate disinformation can be, even on those of us who try to be really diligent at keeping ourselves up on the most accurate and true news on what's happening in Iraq. And essentially, if we can just continue to get this information out, and people back here can be successful at disseminating it and bringing more people into to exposing it to more people, then this will simply – we won't then be involved in figuring out the realities of what's the latest Bush administration story or what is maybe going to be their next one. It's like we can let them twirl off into their own little fantasy realms and losing less and less followers, if you will, as they go along that path and simply continue to tell the truth and get the truth out there. Then I think this will start to affect quite a great change for the better.
Like the salmon on the mountain, says the Dharma got dumb. Hellfire and brimstone, swap for oil and guns. When we're pushing up daisies, we all look the same. In the name of the Father, maybe, but not in my name. On this Jacob's ladder, the only way up is down. One step from disaster, two to make the higher ground. Jacob's ladder.
Told me lying, told me lying. And I said, if you're be slain, and they sent him to the wars to be slain. On this Jacob's ladder, the only way up is down. One step from disaster, two to make the higher ground. On this Jacob's ladder, the only way up is down. One step from disaster, two to make the higher ground. Jacob's ladder.
Forgiveness, do you think that it could? your soul. And I hope that you die, and your death will come soon. I'll follow your casket in the pale afternoon, and I'll waltz as your lord into your deathbed, and I'll stand over your grave till I'm sure that you're dead.
To read more of Dar Jamal's reporting, go to DarJamalIraq.com. That's DarJamalIraq.com. While there, you can sign on to receive his email dispatches. To read about the war from those who are experiencing it firsthand, I suggest you check out several blogs from Iraq. A Family in Baghdad.blogspot.com, riverbendblog.blogspot.com, healingiraq.blogspot.com, and my favorite, astarfrommosul.blogspot.com. We heard music from Frieda Payne, Bring the Boys Home, No Justice, Peter Tosh, Vietnam, Jimmy Cliff, War, Jonatha Brook, 7 O'Clock News, Silent Night, Simon and Garfunkel, Jacob's Ladder, Not in My Name, Chumbawamba, and Masters of War, Pearl Jam. This is WBCR LP 97.7 on your FM dial, broadcasting from downtown Great Barrington in the Berkshire Hills of Western Massachusetts. And this is Mickey Friedman, and this is The Other Side.